Good, good.
I don't know about you, but the things I remember most vividly from my past are the sort of more traumatic events. A long time ago, just after Val and I were married, I was doing business in Libya. In fact, we were designing a port for the Libyan Navy, which meant visiting from time to time. So I was in Libya with my boss. And we'd finished what we were doing and we were driving back to the airport, which was always a great relief to leave Libya. And we stopped for lunch, left our briefcases in the car, and when we got back to the car, they'd been stolen. And foolishly, we'd left our passports in our briefcases. So there we were in Libya. No passports. Now, losing a passport is not too serious. You can normally go to a British embassy and they'll provide you a replacement. But in Libya, it's a bit more difficult. Many of us have been to countries where you need a visa to get into the country. In Libya and one or two other countries, not only do you need a visa to get in, but you need a visa to get out, an exit visa. So we spent the next week visiting various police stations and secret police stations, being questioned by all sorts of strange-looking people who were rather suspicious, because not only had we lost their passports, but we lost all these documents related to their new port. And now I'm a fairly anxious individual. And I would have been absolutely terrified, I think. But I was there with my boss. He was a very experienced traveller. He was a great leader. He was full of confidence and support, an inspiring person. And that made all the difference. And we made it through the experience. I kept saying to the people who were questioning us, "I've just been married. I need to get back." And we did. We got back. We were allowed out. But that made me think what it must have been like for Jesus' disciples. They'd been with Jesus through amazing experiences, but often in very dangerous and difficult and hostile situations. They were threatened by the religious leaders. They were living in a country which was under Roman occupation. But they were with Jesus, and he led them and gave them confidence and support and inspiration, and they trusted him. Whilst they were with Jesus, they had nothing to fear, nothing to worry about. And then suddenly, one day, Jesus says to them, "I'm soon going to be leaving you." They must have been devastated, mustn't they? Who was going to lead them? Who was going to teach them? Who was going to support and encourage them and inspire them? And they expressed their concerns to Jesus, but Jesus said, "Don't worry, I'm going to send my Spirit to be with you." Let's look at the passage in John's Gospel, John chapter 14. Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commands, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to help you and be with you forever, the Spirit of Truth. The world cannot accept him because it neither sees him nor knows him, but you know him, for he lives with you and will be in you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Before long, the world will not see me anymore, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live." Now, if you looked at a number of different English translations of the Bible, you'd see that the translators have great problems with that word that's translated in our version as advocate. Some, you'll see, would use the word counselor. Other places it's comforter. Other places it's helper, and probably several more. And John uses a word that's isn't found elsewhere in the New Testament. It's found four times in his gospel and once in one of his letters, but this word is not found elsewhere in the New Testament. It's found in other books of the time, and it's a legal word. He borrows a term which is used in the legal world. The Greek word is parakletos, and it literally means someone who's called us alongside to help. Hence, a translation of advocate. Well, we can't be exactly sure what John meant in his non-legal use of the term. As I say, it's not found elsewhere in the New Testament. But I think the clues are in the passage which surrounds it. And the first clue is there. He says, I will give you another advocate. In other words, it's going to be a replacement for what Jesus had been to their disciples. I'm going to send my spirit, and he's going to be another one, filling the role that Jesus had been to his disciples. And then a little bit later, a couple of verses later, he says, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Now, he wasn't going to be there physically, but he was going to come to them spiritually. The Spirit was going to be the equivalent to them of what Jesus was in person. And this is Jesus' gift to us, if we're his disciples today. The New Testament is clear to me. If we trust in Jesus and commit to following him, he sends that same Spirit, the Spirit of Jesus, to live in us, to be alongside us, to support us, to strengthen us, to inspire us and to encourage us. It's true for all his followers. It's not just for the clergy or the church leaders. It's not just for the people who regard themselves as sort of spiritual. It's not just for people who lead good lives. It's God's gift through Jesus to all his disciples. And it's something to be thankful for. But what's the purpose of it? Well, the New Testament describes a number of different functions of the Spirit. The Spirit empowers people to do certain things. The Spirit gives a number of different gifts to people for the purpose of building up the church, building up the community of Jesus' followers. Some are mundane, some are more spectacular. But I want to suggest that one of the most important functions of the Spirit of Jesus, is to change his disciples so that they display the characteristics of Jesus in their lives. The characteristics that Paul describes in this passage as the fruit of the Spirit. If I plant a fruit tree in my garden, I might plant it because it looks nice, but frankly other trees look nicer, don't they? Fruit trees aren't much to look at. It might provide some shade, but again, frankly, I'd do better with some other types of tree. I plant a fruit tree so that it bears fruit. That's its purpose. I'll judge its performance on whether it bears fruit. And I would dare to suggest that the most important reason of Jesus' gift of the Spirit to his disciples is that it would bear the fruit that Paul talks about. So let's look back at their verse from Galatians. Not that. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. I want to make four brief points about that. Firstly, These are the characteristics that the world is crying out for, aren't they? Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't the world be a much better place if these were the characteristics that governed the life of my boss, or my teacher, or my neighbours, or my colleagues and friends, or our political leaders? If their lives modelled these characteristics, wouldn't the world be a much better place? Imagine what a positive difference that would make to our lives if those around us displayed these characteristics. Secondly, it's not a list that we're invited to pick and choose from, I think. It's not the sort of list where you can say, well, I'm going to focus on goodness and kindness, but I'm not going to bother too much about the forbearance or the self-control. Or I'll be self-controlled this week, but next week I'm going to go wherever love leads me. No, the fruit is singular, deliberately singular. It's used in the plural elsewhere in the New Testament, but Paul uses it in the singular. Paul is saying that we need to demonstrate the whole package of these things, even those which naturally we find most difficult. And thirdly, these are characteristics that we find very difficult to produce by simply trying harder, whether it's resisting chocolates or something more important. Love. The Beatles sang All You Need Is Love in the 60s. Where do they end up? Writing hateful songs about each other. Suing each other in the courts. Self-control. Many of us, including me, find it almost impossible to exercise enough control over what we eat and drink or what we say behind people's backs, let alone other areas of our lives. There's a simple little poem which I had. Can a tadpole turn into a dog? Can a tiger turn into a frog? Can a hippo grow into a flower by exercising just willpower? Can man, by super restraint, change himself into a saint? Can he cease being decadent by making a god of good intent? Can mankind change as he intends? Well, not until he yields or bends. If he won't bend, the stubborn ox, he'll never even change his socks. It's very difficult by just thinking about it, by making New Year resolutions. To change our characteristics, to change our character. Now these are the fruit of the Spirit. These are what the Spirit of Jesus produces if we allow him to operate in our lives. Not what we produce by our own efforts. And these are the characteristics that we see in Jesus' life. What the Spirit of Jesus aims to do is to transform us so that we become more and more like Jesus in what we do, what we say, and how we think. So lastly and briefly, what do we have to do? The Spirit is a gift from God, which is great news. But do we just sit back and let it happen, wait for God to change us, let go and let God, is the phrase that some have used? Well, yes and no, I don't think so entirely. Let's go back to the passage and look at what Paul says. That the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. We do have a responsibility. We live by the Spirit. If we're a follower of Jesus, that's a given. But Paul says that we need to keep in step with the Spirit. The New Testament, or the NIV version of the New Testament, uses a sort of marching metaphor. I've never done a great deal of marching in my past. I confess I've never really seen much point in it. But the idea is easy to see there. If we're going to march, you've got to follow the pace of a particular person. From what I have done about marching, someone is designated to be the person, and everybody's got to follow him, follow his leading, or her. Other translations talk about being in line with the Spirit, or walking by the Spirit. But the sense is the same. We need to follow the leading of the Spirit and be guided by the Spirit. And that doesn't mean we set our Bibles aside and just ask for the Spirit to guide us through odd thoughts in our heads or random comments from our friends. It would be rather ironic to take one verse out of the Bible use it as a reason for setting aside the rest of it. Now, we need to look to the Bible as the primary means that God has chosen to reveal himself, but ask the Spirit to interpret it to us and apply it to us. And that can all sound a bit nebulous, can't it? A bit ethereal. But let's bring it down to earth. Every day, we make decisions about how we live. What we read, what we watch, who we talk to, what we say. And I think the Bible says, let's take those decisions guided by the Spirit of Jesus, who wants to make us more like him, to produce the fruit of his character in our lives.